Good morning, all. It's another beautiful day. Your attention, please.
Hello, hello. Welcome again to Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast, where we've reached episode 17. Today we're doing Fallout, the series finale. In the notes, which you can find at backinthevillage.com, you can find some information about the comic book sequel I mentioned, Shattered Visage, as well as a link to the Warner Troyer Patrick McGoohan interview we'll be talking about next week. I'd also like to mention that I completely botched the name of the architect of Port Marion and forget exactly what it is. It is, in fact, Clough William Ellis, not Clofton Ellis or whatever I say in the show. Also, be sure to listen to my outro to learn how you can win the snazzy number 6 art print that we will be giving away next episode. So, that's about it. Enjoy Fallout. Good morning, good morning. Welcome again to this beautiful day to Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. I am Clay McCormick from EatDeadMeat.com, and with me, as always, is Wes Teasdale from Penske File. How are you doing, Wes?
Good, Clay. How are you?
I'm good. This is it. We've reached the end. We have finished The Prisoner.
We're done.
And today, we are going to answer the number one question on everyone's mind: how the hell did they afford to use a Beatles song in this show?
It's one of the great questions. This might have been before that was like a problem, right? This probably
it was 68, so it was before the Beatles broke up. I don't know if that matters, but I mean, yeah, copyright stuff and licensing may have been different then.
Or did Beatlemania have like its full copyright hold at that point? You know, they might have been still willing to sell to like car commercials and stuff or whatever. Yeah, they might have been willing at that point. Now they're one of the few bands that refuses to be like on iTunes and stuff like that. So,
Well, Michael Jackson was not old enough yet to buy all the licenses for it.
And welcome to the fourth form of revolt, which is recording a podcast in your one bedroom apartment. So we're here to enlighten everybody.
Number 6 would be proud of us. But yes, we're talking about the final episode, Fallout. This is probably one of the more unique episodes of television I've ever seen. It takes what was already a strange, surreal show with metaphorical undertones and just, you know, locks the wheel and drives off a cliff into, allegory metaphorville. So we're going to try the best that we can to explain what happens. I guess actually the through line of action is not as difficult as it was to talk about last week. It seems when you kind of line it up, it's actually not that bad. Last week was a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Well, it was very simplistic in what actually happened. There's just a lot of things that happened within the very limited thing that happened, if that makes sense. there was a lot of aspects to a very simple plot last week.
Right.
And this week, at least, there's at least 5 different stages of the plot.
Right,
in this one.
Right.
We draw your attention to the regrettable bullet. The community is at stake, and we have the means to protect it.
The assembly is now in security.
Number 6 is presented to you.
We understand he survived the ultimate test.
Indeed.
Then he must no longer be referred to as number 6 or a number of any kind. He has gloriously vindicated the right of the individual to be individual. And this assembly rises to you, sir.
And so, it picks off right up... picks up right where the last episode left off.
Yeah.
which we see in a pre-credits. It's the only time they do a last time on the prisoner type thing. And we see a recap of Once Upon a Time, which actually, even watching the recap of Once Upon a Time doesn't really tell you what happened in that episode.
No.
They just kind of cherry pick a bunch of good, like, interesting moments.
Yes.
And then get to the end where number two dies and Baldy comes in and says, you want to go see number one.
Yeah, for how little it tells about you, it goes on for a long time.
Yeah, it's they kinda, cover...
It's a very long recap.
They cover everything like they're trying to make sure you know exactly what's going on, but... Unless you've watched the, I mean, obviously, I hope you watched the whole show. But if you were like on vacation that week and didn't catch Once Upon a Time,
yeah.
And then came back to watch the finale, I don't really know if it would make a lot of sense.
At least how he ended up there. Yeah. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the end where he drops dead is pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, that's very clear.
There's a different credit sequence than we usually get. They don't do the normal.
Waking up in the village.
Yeah, the waking up and the resign intro. They do, all they have, they do is they put, have a aerial shot of Port Marion, and they have a title saying exactly where Port Marion is.
Yep.
So.
And thanking the most British sounding person in the world, it's like Sir Clayton Clawton.
Something Clofton Ellis, I believe. I can't remember his first name.
But that's the guy
who built
Port And he was Marion. A sir, right? He had a
yes,
sir?
Yeah. And so I think the reason they probably do that is so when you get to the end of this episode and you're totally pissed off that they didn't answer any of your questions, they can say, no, we did answer one question. Because everyone probably wants to know where we shot this, and we told you.
You can take out your feather and inkwell and write a letter to Sir Barrister...
Sir Clofton Ellis.
Clofton Ellis.
Kindest regards, prisoner fans.
Dearest sir, I watched this episode.
so then they jump right into it. They bring number six... down through all of the underground passageways, and they let him discard his prisoner, his village attire in favor of his own suit. When they say,
"Oh yeah, that's right,"
they say, "We thought you'd be more comfortable as yourself," which is kind of a callback to Dance of the Dead,
mm-hmm.
where he gets the when his costume for the costume party is just a tuxedo.
Yep.
And he takes that as meaning that he is still himself. Then he's led down a underground corridor filled with jukeboxes playing All You Need Is Love by the Beatles to a giant door that says welcome, split into two words.
Yep.
This whole episode, that should be a bit of foreshadowing for the whole episode, because this episode is rife with puns and alliterative puns.
Yep.
And he's brought into this kind of James Bondy lair. Yeah. With, you know, stalactites hanging down from the cavern ceiling, and the spinning camera guy rig is now a spinning machine gun rig.
Yep.
And that's actually one of the things I love about this episode is, as we might talk about later, McGoohan was pressed for time when writing this. Last week I mentioned that he wrote Once Upon a Time in 36 hours. I think that was wherever I read that, I think they were incorrect.
Okay.
Because I was reading up on this episode, and they said this episode was written in 36 hours.
Sure.
And one of the great things about it is, like, every prop they have access to through the entirety of the show, they basically find a use for.
Mm-hmm.
They repurpose the spinning cameras as the machine gun turret. They use the lighthouse rocket set as number one's lair. Et cetera.
Reuse characters.
They reuse characters and actors. Everything they have access to is put to good use in this episode.
Yeah.
So he's brought into this James Bond villain lair type cavern.
Also, does Austin Powers, is that parodying how these henchmen look? They look exactly the same as they do in Austin. They have the helmet.
Yeah,
they
actually do. That's a good point. I never thought about that. It's very possible.
Okay.
I mean, I guess technically this falls under the same milieu. So he's brought into this Bondian cavern and presented with this guy dressed as a judge who is the same actor that played the Napoleon character in The Girl Who Was Deaf.
Dr. Schmidt or something.
Yeah. And he's sort of this... he's not really... He's more of a judge. I've seen him referred to as the president, but yeah. He's more of a judge than a president. And behind him is this big gathering of faceless people with white robes and masks that are half white and half black.
Yep.
And in front of them, in sort of like a UN fashion, are these little placards that have all of these different social constructs and measures of control, such as identification, defectors, therapy, reactionists, nationalists, and anarchists.
Therapists was my favorite.
And
the early seeds of Scientology,
yeah,
being sown.
Well, I actually had a thought about that as we get into it later. But so from that point, all these people welcome Number Six and say that he has won the ultimate. He has finished the ultimate test. He's beaten the village, so he has earned the opportunity, or I should say that he's earned the right to no longer be referred to as a number, but as be referred to as sir,
yep,
as a man.
Yep.
And there's a big throne waiting for him, and basically they are going to transfer total power of the village to Number Six.
Yep.
And before they can do that, they go through what the judge refers to as a tedious ceremony that is always accompanied with the transfer of ultimate power.
Yeah.
Which involves a trial of sorts on two other kinds of revolt. Number Six being the third kind of revolt. These two other different kinds of revolt are represented as Number 48, played by Alexis Kanner, who once again gets a box around his name in the credits, because I guess Magoo must really just like him a lot.
Sure.
Understandably, because he's great. And he is the representation of youth and youthful revolt. And the other representation of revolt, in more of a company man who decides that he doesn't want to
toe the company line.
Yeah, he doesn't want to boss around anymore. He doesn't want to much like the Number Six was before he resigned.
Yep.
Is represented by the recently departed Number Two, who is brought back to life with a totally new haircut and hair color by the village.
McKern.
Yes, sorry, Leo McKern. Yes. And after these two have their moment of trial,
it's more of a confession, right? They want them to confess.
Yeah. I guess to confess that what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's no evidence presented. They basically are just like, you tell me something, and that's it.
Yeah, and they're kind of sort of representative of. With everything in this episode, you can kind of read it however you want.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of reading it as though they are both kind of representative of aspects of Six. But, you don't necessarily have to read it that way.
Yep.
there's no judgment made, because they keep turning to Six for some sort of judgment. He's just noting the proceedings.
Yeah, yeah, noted.
And so after their trial, they start the transfer of ultimate power and give him the option to either lead them or go. He is free to do whatever he wants, and he can stay there and lead the village and tell them what to do, because they've come around to realize that he is right.
Yep.
He is his way is the right one. They should follow him. Or they give him the option to go. They set him up with his house, his car, a million traveler's checks. Which they do a cutback to McGowan when they say traveler's checks a million, and he makes this kind of face, which is kind of like traveler's checks.
I thought it was funny they gave him $1 million in traveler's, or £1 million or whatever in traveler's checks, and then they gave him some petty cash.
Yeah.
Just walking around money.
They gave him $1 million in traveler's checks and like $14.50 in loose change.
Just in case you can't get to like a Western Union to cash his traveler's check. Here's a couple coins.
Do you remember when there used to be commercials for traveler's checks?
Yes.
I never see them anymore. Are they defunct? Do people use them anymore?
I don't think so. I think because credit cards have now caught up to being superior. I think the thing was it used to take too long for your credit cards to be verified that the charges were legitimate. So now when I buy something online from an overseas company, it shows up immediately. Yeah. So it's like, you know when things are. But no, I haven't seen. Traveler's checks are a relic, I think, of the past. Yeah.
Yeah, like much like the old, well, at the conventions that I do, you know, you can charge credit cards on your phone now, which is amazing.
Yep.
So I've always wanted to buck that trend and be the guy who's got one of those old school giant heavy credit card things that you give them a carbon copy back and you have to wait until it clears.
Yeah, it's definitely, and then be like, ooh, like have a fax machine next to you. Be like, can I fax the receipt?
Or just let everybody pay by check.
Sir, we crave your indulgence for a short while. The transfer of ultimate power requires some tedious ceremony, and perhaps you would care to observe the preliminaries from the chair of honor.
Anyway, so he's given the option to lead or to leave, and after that, they direct him to the missile silo with a big number one on it that's been presiding over all of the proceedings, and they say, well, that's where number one is. Go ahead and meet him. So he goes into there and he sees number four.
Well, excuse me, but I think you missed the most important part. He's allowed to give a speech to the assembly.
I'm sorry. Yes, they allow him to take the podium and give a speech, and when he gets up there, he starts to talk, but is instantly drowned out by the hooded and masked crowd chanting I, which again I think is another play on words because it's either chanting I as in the letter I, or I as
like
in
I myself.
Yeah, I as in I myself, or I as in like yes. You could take it either way.
Yep.
But you know, it's Six has very little dialogue in this episode, and that instance he's given the opportunity to make some grand statement, and you know, he's talking, but he's drowned out and we don't know what he's saying.
Yep.
And he's very disturbed and weirded out by it, which I think is my favorite bit of acting from McGoohan in the episode when he's dealing with that.
That's my favorite part of the episode.
Yeah, it's great. And so then he's led to the missile silo with the one on it to meet number one, and inside he sees 48 and number two in these like tubes that say Orbit 48 and Orbit 2. So I assume they're going to launch them into space.
Oh, okay. That's the simplest.
I don't know.
I didn't understand. I read it. I was misreading. I thought it said Obit, and I was like, oh, they're dead or something. It's like, no, it says Orbit.
I think it says Orbit.
It does say Orbit, but I was like, Orbit doesn't make sense. Maybe I guess they are supposed to go into space.
I don't know. Why not?
Yeah.
So then he climbs the spiral staircase up into number one's room. And this is the moment of truth. This is what
the exact same one as in the rocket episode?
I think so.
Okay. That spiral staircase was familiar.
Yeah. It's the same set. So we've reached the point that everyone's been waiting for, the reveal of number one. And he goes into this room, which is filled with the globes of the Earth.
Yep.
And number one is sitting in front of a TV screen with his back to number six. And on the TV screen is sort of a reverse shot of number six coming towards number one. So what we're seeing is the backs of both characters. And what is on the screen is the front of both characters. And as he gets closer, they start playing...
His I Will Not Be Filed.
Yeah, yes, his famous I Will Not Be Pushed, Stamped, Filed, Briefed, Indexed, Debriefed, or Numbered. And number one slowly turns to him, hands him a crystal ball, which he looks into and sees the image that ends every episode of his face coming towards the camera with the bars slamming in front. He drops the ball. It shatters on the ground. He reaches for the black and white mask to unmask number one, pulls it off, and reveals another mask, which is that of a monkey. And then reaches for that one, pulls that one off, and sees
a
twisted version of himself. You only get, I think in the episode, that he's only on screen for maybe like 5 seconds.
Number one, number six, you mean?
Yes, number
yeah,
one.
It's probably even... It's so little time. I think you could have, if you sneezed while it was happening, you'd probably have missed it. And seeing as this came out in the 60s, you'd be like, what happened? Like,
exactly.
Looking around.
And that, I think, happened a lot because people were not happy with this episode when it
came
out.
No, I feel they could have shown him a little bit longer. It's real quick.
Yeah.
I understand the artistic thing to do it real quick, but it is... It's so quick, you might not realize what you're looking at.
Yeah, it's. I actually thought they showed him less than they do, because he pulls the monkey mask off, and he sees himself, and number one just starts cackling like a madman.
That first, when he pulls the monkey mask off, and it's the first him, it's a little tough to tell it's Magoon, because he still has his hood on.
Yes,
so it's like, you're looking, you're like, I think that's him, but it's hard to tell.
And then he kind of freaks out, and they start chasing each other around the room. And then number one runs up into the, I don't even know what you, I guess the nose cone of the rocket. And
yeah, it's like the sub where the little like, the like where you can drop the little twisty door, the hatch or whatever.
And he leans over there, and you get a good look at his face. And you can see that it clearly is Patrick McGoohan's face.
Yep.
So, which, of course, I guess means that Flapjack Charlie is number one, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Curtis is just a unlucky resembler number one, I suppose.
So you see his face, and like I watch it, could have been
Curtis, I guess. Now that I think about it, right? There's no reason why it's not Curtis.
Well, I guess he's dead, but maybe he's not dead. I don't know.
No, he went.
That scene where he looks down and you get a good look at his face, I always forget that scene's in there. And I, for some reason in my head, I only remember the scene where he pulls the mask off.
Yeah.
So every time I see him looking down, I'm like, oh, I guess they show him a little bit more than I remember. But still, in 1968, that's, like you said, if you sneeze, you're going to miss it.
Yeah.
And that's the last you see of number one. And from that point, number six has made his decision that he is going to leave the village. And he starts twisting all the knobs on the missile silo, which turns out to be a giant rocket, much like in The Girl Who Was Deaf. He frees number two and number 48 from their orbit chambers, and they have this very James Bond-type, basically, massacre.
They all
three of them get machine guns and
forgetting the butler.
Oh, the butler, too, yes. They all get machine guns and just start icing everybody. They just come out guns blazing, and they shoot one of the guys on the spinning machine gun turret, and they do that thing where like he leans into it and the gun starts firing as it starts spinning and just killing everybody.
Yep.
And the judge calls for an evacuation of the village because the rocket silo starts shaking. It's gonna take off, and we see the village evacuating and helicopters going up, and then number two, number 48, number six, and the butler all get into the mobile RV unit that we saw in Once Upon a Time. And they just drive out through the underground tunnel that leads to the exit, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And as they leave, the number one rocket is seen blasting up into space. And then they drive home and have a nice little...
they go back to work.
Yeah, they have some tea, have a nice little dance on their way home, celebrating that they've escaped, I guess. And number 48 is dropped off on the road because he's a dirty hippie and is a hitchhiker.
Yeah.
Number two is dropped off at Westminster Palace, I believe.
Yeah.
And then number six goes home. And in a nice continuation of all the ambiguity of everything that's come before, when you get to his house, as he's walking up to the house, we see the hearse with the top hat guys that we see at the beginning of every episode drive by the house.
Yep.
And then he gets in his car and drives off, and the butler goes up to number six's door, and number six's door, which is number one Buckingham Place, opens with the same door opening noise that it does in the village.
Automation.
Same automation, and then closes behind him, and we get the thunderclap and the shot of him driving down the tarmac that we get at the beginning of every episode. I don't know. We can talk about what that's supposed to mean or what... But that's the end of the episode. That's the end of the series.
That's the end of The Prisoner. The end.
Yeah. Or is it?
Or is it? Well, it's cyclical, just like The Wire.
I didn't. I feel I feel
I
violation of the pine.
I glass.
I feel that the swipe cape is taking Christendom.
So what'd you think?
I like this one. I thought it was, I think it's one of the better runs of the show. It has some, I wrote them down. It has one great scene, a few good, a couple random ones that I don't think amount to much. Mm-hmm. And then it's sort of, it has a couple phases that I don't really like. I like the trial. Well, there's only one. I like the trial.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like their escape.
Yeah.
I kind of don't like the reveal of one, and then I really like the end, like the very end.
Yeah.
So it kind of goes like that. I feel the like I was saying, the best part I think is his speech where he gets drowned out.
Mm-hmm.
That was the part of the episode that actually said something, I think, about what he was trying to get across. Mm-hmm. And then I just thought the escape was a little cliche, a little undeserved. I thought
The interesting thing about the escape that I've always wondered about is, much like the way we talked about, I can't remember if I've heard him talk about this or read an interview where he talked about this, but much like we were talking about with the girl who was deaf, where it seems like it's kind of a parody of spy stuff.
Yep.
I've heard him talk about how. Or other people connected talk about how do you end the show? Because people want number one to be like, you know, oh, there's Sean Connery sitting there. It's like, I'm number one, and here's what the village is, and this is why you're here, et cetera, right. Et cetera. They want a very James Bond kind of ending.
The architect from The Matrix.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Something along those lines.
Don't even get me started. And I feel like that ending or the escape is sort of a way to justify or not justify, but it's that sort of placating of what people would expect the ending to be after 35 minutes of what seems to be nonsense.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Although I feel this one did a better job of making a point about what it was talking about than a lot of the other episodes, which to me feel much more like they're just nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm not saying that I think it's
right,
nonsense.
If
I'm just saying that for a lot of people
it.
Who are watching
sure,
it,
sure.
who didn't really get what was going on.
Yeah.
Watching 35 minutes of that. And then it's like, okay, well now this is how he's going to get out. He's just going to shoot his way out.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, you know, that ending, that sequence has...
I did love the music over it. This episode had greatest use of music, I think.
Even
outside of the Beatles, All You Need Is Love, they did... It was like a Prisoner Greatest Hits. They pull like all the music that's sort of memorable, and they play it sort of randomly.
Yeah, there's like a musical sequence with the Them Bones.
There's Them Bones. Piece. There's that the coolest music the show ever did, which is that dramatic sort of like synth thing that when they're carrying off the 48 or whatever. And then there's McKern has another music thing while he's there, and then they have All You Need Is Love, which probably made that scene. I don't think that scene's very good. I was reading he was trying to play just a whole shit ton of songs at the same time in that scene, and they decided it was way too chaotic.
Okay.
And so they just settled on one song.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I can see it being, I mean, yeah, that's there's so much going on screen that having like a bunch of songs
just noise
playing
on top of it, yeah.
Would
be
too much. But yeah, the strangeness of that the way they escape has even lent itself to theories about what happens in the episode. because I've seen places where people think that the fact that he gets out so easily and in the way that he does is an indication that he actually does get broken. And, like, that's some fantasy of how he gets out of the village. You know, like, kind of, yeah, like, you ever see Brazil?
Yeah.
Kind of like the end of Brazil.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, sure, why not? I mean, this is one of those things where you could really read this however you want, and I'm not necessarily going to tell you you're wrong.
Yeah. I guess I'll save my overall point, I think, for we'll probably conclude with what we think the overall point of it is. I was saying earlier, I thought that what they were saying here through the whole trial aspect was like the clearest the show has kind of ever been. The sort of different forms of revolt is an interesting thing to do. The best scene where he gets shouted out is the best. I wish it had almost ended on that scene.
That would have been interesting. Yeah.
Should I talk about why that's my favorite scene?
Sure,
I guess?
Go for it.
The scene where he gets shouted out is my favorite scene because if the series theme is about individuality versus sort of a collectiveness, it's sort of a cool reversal on the individual always being superior when he is allowed to be an individual. But when you are an individual, when you say something, you're basically being drowned out by other individuals. Like, that's what society kind of is.
Yeah.
Like, your individuality goes away because there's a whole bunch of individuals sitting around together.
Right.
And they all start talking at once and it becomes nothing.
Yeah.
If you're not on the same page, which is what the village is, ironically. Right. Like, the village is on the same page. So, and that's his sort of shock. That's the reason he's like upset when that happens, is because he's sort of realized that his individuality has hit the problem point of how far it can possibly go.
Yeah.
And that's why I really enjoy that scene. And it's, I don't know if that would have been too downer of an ending. It's not really a downer, but it certainly would have, if he doesn't end the series sort of with a chance of winning, I feel that's kind of an odd choice for the series to make.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
You are free to go.
Free to go?
Anywhere.
Why?
You have been such an example to us.
Why?
You have convinced us of our mistakes.
Why?
You are pure, you know the way, show us.
Why?
Your revolt is good and honest. You are the only individual. We need you.
I see.
You do. You see all.
I'm an individual?
You are on your own.
I fail to see.
All about you is yours. We concede. We offer, we plead for you to lead us.
Or go.
Go if you wish.
I don't know.
I know what you mean. I think you're right. And I think that kind of plays into the way that I tend to read the whole episode in that, here's a question. Do you think that they are actually giving him control? Like, do you think they're actually, the village is actually conceding to defeat? Or do you think this is just another ploy?
I think it's sort of both.
Yeah.
I think they're sort of ceding him, but are ceding it to him. But at the same time, they know that that is a win for them.
Yeah, yeah. I think the thing is that what they're doing, because they lay it on so thick, it's kind of like arguing with a child,
right?
Where you get to a certain breaking point,
which
and
is
then,
fitting because they keep calling each other daddy, in
right?
This episode.
And actually, he even does. There's a few episodes ago we were talking about how. I don't know why they don't just do the child thing where they just keep asking why.
Yeah, that,
and
that
he
was,
does that.
Louis C.K. should have just walked on.
Yeah.
on frame and then,
and
give it to me, baby.
Yeah, it's that it's like dealing with a child where you get to a breaking point and you're like, fine, whatever you want. You want that toy? You can have the toy. Just shut up. Just leave me. You know. Right. And it's like that kind of thing where they can't force him to do what they want. They can't break him. So they just lean into the fact. They're like, you know what? You're right. You are the greatest. You are the person who, the only one who's right. You do deserve to have absolute power. We're going to give you a throne. We're going, you know, they lean into it. And I think that's actually kind of a really interesting comment on, for a show that is so much about the individual and remaining yourself among things that are trying to oppress you.
Yeah.
This episode, I think, actually starts laying into some of the negatives of that.
Yep.
Because I feel like the scene where he's giving the speech, as well as this whole proceeding, is kind of a comment on the narcissism that's involved with being a complete individual.
Right. Well, it goes hand in hand with his, I did love his, as I'm getting older, his sort of like cynical take on youthful revolt.
Yeah.
Being like, you're not really rebelling against anything. You're just kind of a jackass wearing like silly clothes.
And yes.
The line he says something like, youth with like bells on their shoes.
Yeah. With their enthusiasms.
But it's like the 48, who's this Canner.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be a mod, like the mod fashion from the 60s Britain, but that's sort of analogous to like modern day hipster culture.
Yeah,
he's sort of similar. So it's sort of like I just appreciated the fact that the script and the show didn't see his revolt as particularly good because it was kind of pointless.
Yeah, I think it still sees it as good.
There's flaws to why they're trying to do it. They're saying that this youthful rebellion is not particularly focused on anything. It's just sort of being chaotic.
Yes.
Which is not particularly productive.
Right.
And the other guy is sort of weird because, you know, number two is because we've supported you and now you're going to turn your back on us.
Right.
It's kind of like his moral dilemma or whatever. Like that's his. The problem, I think, is that sixes, I don't understand sixes individuality, how it's different.
Yeah.
I thought that was really kind of a weak point though. Like they gave two great examples of rebellion and then they're like, and here's Six who is perfect at rebellion.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't understand why he's perfect.
Well, I was wondering that too, because yeah, I really noticed this time how they were talking about the two specific kinds of revolt and then they get to Six and they don't really don't really get into it. And I was thinking, maybe that's part of the thing that I'm thinking is like, well, it's like, but you do it the best.
Right, yeah.
You are the master of pissing people off and revolting. Everything you do is for reasons that are 100% pure. And you know what?
Do the little kiss of the fingers. Like,
yeah. Mwah. Like the exploding asshole, like Louis C.K. says.
Yeah.
I think it's a really, if that was the intent, I mean, even if it wasn't the intent, I think you can read it that way. And it's a really interesting point to make. When you've followed your hero this far and have really driven home what he stands for and what the importance of his character is,
yeah,
and then in his moment of triumph, you're also undercutting him and saying, well, I mean, yes, this is important, but here's some of the negatives associated with the character.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Because
it's like, he's such a, we've talked about him as such a moral and archetypal, like absolute character.
Yeah.
That the fact that they take time to explore the flaws inherent in that character.
Yep.
I find really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's why the episode's good. This is kind of, I've mentioned it before, but it's like, this is kind of what I was hoping the show would do.
Yeah.
It took a very long time and it only really started doing it in the final episode.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's, you know, everyone's like, because the point of view is like, it's sort of like equality. It's like everyone understands equality is good. Like individuality is a good thing.
Right.
Like, so a show sort of telling me that is, even though individuality and equality are just constructs, like they don't actually exist. It's just a made up myth of humans that we've made. Same with any other thing. The fact that they're going to explore negatives of these things that up to this point had been like, yeah, this is kind of self-evident. It makes it much more interesting at a certain point. I felt the show had to do it. I'm glad they finally did.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that this episode was written and directed by McGoohan, because, you know, he is so, you know, identified with number six, and I think so much of his personality is seemingly projected onto number six. And, you know, as we've gone through, we've talked about how, he was hard to work with. He seemed like the embodiment of the Six character. Like, yeah, Six was not so much a character, but it was just Patrick McGoohan doing what he thought, like
his sort of philosophy.
Yes, was talking about his own philosophy. So it's really nice to see that when you get to this point, this person, McGoohan, it's not like he's got blinders on, but like he understands what the upsides and downsides to this character or this stance are.
Right.
And I think it's really interesting that he chose to explore them like that.
Yeah. And he's not in the episode very much at all.
No.
He's really just sitting there.
Yeah. Like I said, he doesn't have much dialogue at all. He says, he's probably got less than a page of dialogue across the entire thing.
Yep.
Noted.
Not at this time, no.
Not at this time.
Young man.
You got a message.
I just got it.
What gives?
You've never been with it, I mean with us.
I'm gone away.
But you were here, then you went and gone.
Got the word?
Oh, yes.
The bright light, Dad. Got the sign.
Sign?
The light.
Light?
The message.
Then you went and gone.
Why?
Give it to me, baby.
That's it.
Give me the rest.
Give all you want, give. That's it.
That's it.
And take.
That's it.
Takes all you want.
That's it.
Take.
That's it.
Take.
Take, take.
Take, take.
Take. Take. Take. Take.
So the thing that I find so interesting about this episode is, well, first of all, I love this episode, and which leads into what I find so interesting about it, which is I think I watched this episode more than any other episode of the show.
Yeah.
It's like more quotable.
Yep.
It's easier to, if I'm putting something on while I'm working and I want to watch The Prisoner, 9 times out of 10, I put on this episode.
Sure.
Because there's just something about it that is just, it's got like it's a much different feel in terms of the content than the other episodes. There's like a dance sequence kind of.
When they're riding 48, off the end.
No, well that, or, but also when 48 is getting into the banter with the judge. And
that
then,
was bizarre. I don't know.
And then he starts, the judge goes, now you're hip. And he goes, hip? And then he starts doing the hip bone, knee bone, leg bone. And then the music starts and everybody starts dancing.
So you see it as dance. I thought they were freaking out because he's being too disruptive. You're talking about the guys in white who are like spinning around?
Yeah, they do that. At the first time when he first shows up and he's running around and he's jumping through everything, which I thought was a really nice illustration of the point they're trying to get across, because they've got this jury of people that are supposed to be representative of all these social constructs, and to have this character that's supposed to represent unbridled youth running around and to all these different stations. You've got the social construct, you've got like a scientific state, just causing chaos through all these things, was a really nice illustration.
Yeah.
Once the music starts, everybody starts like dancing. Like there's a great shot of number six as he's sitting on the throne, but the guards to either side of him are kind of like gently swaying to the music.
It's good. It's although I mean, if I never hear Dem Bones again, it would be too soon. I think the episode ran Dem Bones into the ground for me.
Oh, well, then you probably shouldn't listen to the finished cut of this podcast.
Hear the word of the Lord. Guilty!
But yeah, there's a shot of the judge who's when everybody's dancing, like he's like he's clapping along, but he's doing so like begrudgingly. He's got right. like this grimace on his face, like I can't believe I have to do this. Yeah, there's just something about it. There's an energy to it and a life to it that I find it's just really and all the performances are really good and they're really kind of out there.
Yep. This is one of the few episodes, I think, where the theme was portrayed through the actions of stuff that was happening.
Yeah.
Like you were just like youthful, like the symbolism of him sort of causing chaos, just mm-hmm. even not even intentionally mm-hmm. sort of like just his nature is causing all these problems is thematically demonstrating what the show is talking about, which it doesn't always do.
Yeah.
Sometimes it'll hint at it, but what'll happen will have nothing to do with whatever that is.
Yeah.
I did think number two had a tougher, the McKern thing was mm-hmm. not as strong. I don't know what they could have done. They're kind of trapped. It's hard to demonstrate that, I think. They do it, but it's not as effective.
Yeah, it's, I like what they do with him. I think, I really like the idea of them bringing him back to life. Because it's kind of like the company owns every part of you, they even get to determine when you die kind of thing. And we finally find out what those suction cup things on the Daleks from Doctor Who are, because I guess you put one over your face and it shaves you clean. I like what they do with him because I think you're right. I don't think it's as clear or as well illustrated as the number 48 stuff. But I still think it works because
it does,
you've got some little things that seem weird that this time I was picking up, reading a little differently, like when he first comes back to life and he goes over to the assembly and he says something really strange happened to me on my way, and then he pauses and he says here.
Yep.
And then everybody starts laughing. And it's like, oh, okay, isn't like the kind of like lame humor that placates and all that kind of stuff that a politician might have. And you know, he gets into his backstory, or I should say his symbolic backstory, because we don't know if any of this is actually true. But, of being someone of considerable power that, you know, had toppled governments and had the ears of kings and stuff. And the point that he drives home there, which I think is probably the closest mirror or the closest element that makes this two specifically a mirror of six, is that he talks about how I knew eventually that you would have a use for me, but my biggest regret is that I didn't hold out longer.
Right.
And he then uses that opportunity to kind of complete the rebellion that he wishes he had done before.
Yep.
Which includes literally spitting in the eye of number one.
Yeah.
Which was nice because the... number one is represented by the missile silo, but it uses another prop from the rest of the show, that eye-looking light thing in the control room is, you know, glued to the front of it and is blinking like an eyeball. And so, I used to think was kind of lame, or it was like, that's kind of obvious, but I really like the imagery of Six asks number two, have you ever seen him? And he's like, what? No, of course I haven't.
Right. Yeah.
And then two uses that opportunity to, like I said, complete his rebellion and look him directly in the eye, or as close as he'll ever get, and then spit in the eye of number one, which freaks the whole thing starts shaking and smoke starts coming out. And that's when they, I don't know if I would say convict him, but they ask number six to offer sentencing, and he says something like, at the end of my arraignment what's the word?
His
not induction, inauguration.
Inauguration, yeah. Sure.
I think you're right. I think it's a little bit less clear exactly. It's hard to do visually, I guess.
Yep.
But I think it's handled pretty well. I really like both of those sequences. There's enough scene chewing going on for anybody.
Yep.
And they both take advantage of it completely and just lay into it, which
they do.
Really allows a lot of fun acting choices. And it's cool that McGoohan kind of takes a back seat and lets everybody else ham it up for an episode.
Yeah, he wrote and directed. He's tired.
Yeah. I'm sure he was very tired.
He's probably directing from that chair. He's just like, I'm just going to sit in this chair.
Well, one of the things that I read was the guy who plays the judge claims that he wrote most of his own dialogue.
Yeah, I saw that too.
I don't really know. I mean, if he wrote most of his own dialogue, he was dialed into what was going on because all of his dialogue was pretty much on point.
Yeah, I don't know if it was all. He said he wrote the big speech he had to give, and he gave it to McGoohan for like approval. And he said,
really?
That's fine or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Yeah, I mean, if so, I mean, kudos to McGoohan for getting the idea across and making sure that everyone knew what was going on.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he continues to be the series' best director.
Yep.
Sir, on behalf of us all, we thank you. And now I take it that you are prepared to meet number one. Follow me, if you would be so kind. Sir.
But yeah, so let's talk about the number one scene a little bit. You were saying you were a little bit disappointed with it or wish they had done it differently or something.
Yeah, I think I don't know if I predicted it, but it's not a surprise kind of.
Right.
It's like, that feels like that would be if you were writing a show like this, that feels like that would be the standard fallback, like 60% of the time. You'd be like, you are number one. And it's like, oh, okay. Like I get the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not. I almost wish there was no number one. I didn't really care about number one.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting thing, which was something that occurred to me. I think when I watched it through the first time, and one of the things that really stood out to me that made me love the show is that when this show aired, it had a huge, huge viewership because everybody wanted to know who number one was. Because they bring it up at the beginning of every episode.
Yeah.
And when it played out the way it did, everybody freaked out. Everybody hated it. McGoohan claims that he had to go into hiding for like 2 weeks, which I'm sure has not a little bit of hyperbole sprinkled across the top of it. I'm sure he had some people, you know.
He didn't leave his house for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm sure he had some people, you know, who were angry about it. I don't know if he...
His mailman is like, what's the deal
with
his...
Hey, what's going on? Why didn't you? Who's number one?
I sneezed.
I'm going to put a bomb in your mailbox.
I sneezed. I missed it. What the hell happened?
Yeah. I had to go to the bathroom. I've been delivering your mail for 12 years. You could at least tell me who number one is. I don't know why.
He's an Italian Bronx guy. He's like,
I don't know why the British mailman is from the Jersey Shore, but hey, people live everywhere. That's what it's about globalization. It's, you know.
Hey, I'm walking here.
Yeah. I'm walking across to A20. Oh. Anyway, so yeah, people did not respond super well to the episode. And
just surprising to me. I don't know if it's hindsight thing. I never watched this show thinking I was going to get an answer. There's no part of the show that I'm like, well, number one is certainly going to make an appearance and I'm going to get all the answers that I want. It's like the show never set itself up like that.
Right. And I wonder if that is something that is unique to the fact that we've been watching
a lot of TV
that's come a long way since The Prisoner.
Yeah.
I don't know how... I mean, when this aired, it was unique enough as it was, but I mean, to have a show like this with an open ending the way it does was probably even more unique, you know?
Yeah, I think it's...
Had there even been shows that had completed their series
at that
point?
I was wondering if, like, if you gave me the season or series finale for a lot of shows back then, would I be like, oh, this is definitely ending, or it would just be a normal episode that's like, now it's over.
I mean, even the end of Danger Man, Kuroshi and Shindashima doesn't
just
feel...
just kind of an episode.
Yeah, it's just sort of like a long episode.
I mean, yeah, Twilight Zone, Star Trek didn't... Twilight Zone would have just been... an episode of Twilight Zone.
I mean, most British shows either ran for like 5 episodes or ran for 60 years. So.
Mission Impossible, I'd assume, just ended like with a regular thing.
Mission Impossible ran into the 70s.
Oh, okay.
You know,
yeah,
I mean, I think, I don't know when The Fugitive was on, but I think The Fugitive ends with him not, I honestly don't. I'm only kind of going from what I remember from the movie.
I think he sort of wraps it up at the end of The Fugitive, yeah. Right? Because I think it's sort of similar to the movie, or am I talking out of my ass? Like, not exactly like the movie, but...
Yeah, I honestly don't know.
Okay, yeah.
I think... Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, it's just... Well, it's weird because I don't consider the ending that ambiguous. I consider the ending of The Sopranos to be more ambiguous than this is.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Because I feel it's well, sort of lays out what happened here.
That's the other thing that I love about this episode is because... So, to finish what I was going to say before, everybody freaked out over this episode because it didn't seem like an ending at the time, and you didn't really find out. I mean, number one, you didn't really find out who number one was, even though you do. and it really drives. I find it really dials in a point that it only occurred to me after I finished watching the whole series. Which is that number one doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who number one is.
No.
At all. I mean, they bring it up every episode, but it does not matter.
Right.
And that's part of the brilliance of the framing device they give you is because they set up so many of these things that seem like questions that need to and should be answered. But in the grand scheme of things, the answer to those questions does not matter.
Right.
It does not affect the show. Finding out who number one is not going to... I mean, change the show questions.
Well, finding out it's Magoon doesn't change anything particularly at all.
No,
it sort of adds a layer of you are the village, kind of, but it's not... You kind of get that idea. With the ending does it much more effectively than revealing...
Yeah, and the thing that I love about the ending is, you know, for a long... I mean, it's... People refer to it as ambiguous, and it's not really an ending. George Markstein... fucking hated it,
yeah,
because I think he was just a bitter
sour,
old asshole.
Sour grapes at that point.
Yeah, I saw an interview with him where he was like, it was just a bunch of nonsense, it was a pantomime, you can't end a TV, there was no ending at all.
Yeah,
it's like, but if you watch the episode, they like answer a lot of questions, just not the way you want them to.
Yeah,
you know, it gives you an ending, it gives you a fairly, you know, a fairly real ending without being in your face and having him like, I mean, they do technically have him drive off into the sunset,
yep.
But it doesn't mean exactly what you think it's going to mean.
Yeah, it must be a product of the time. It certainly feels like it wraps itself.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know what else you could, what else are you looking for? I don't know. What isn't explained.
I saw another interview with one of the, I think the art director or the line producer, I can't remember who it was, where he was saying, it's like everyone, like I said before, everyone expected this James Bond kind of ending, but it's the wrong way to end the show, but it's also the right way to end the show. Because this show is never going to have that James Bond, you know, I am number one ending.
Right.
And I think this ending is totally in line with everything they've done before.
Yeah. I think it goes too far. Like I'm not crazy about their... I consider the escape part of their ending. I'm not crazy about that part. Mm-hmm. I'm not crazy about the fact that the village is 20 miles away from London. That sort of annoyed me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I kind of give it a little bit of artistic leeway there.
I don't understand.
Like, you know, maybe it's longer than that. They just cut.
They cut to that, but it's like, I don't...
They've just been dancing for a long time.
Right. Yeah. It's a very long album. I didn't feel the need to see them get back to London. You know, I'd been happy if they just got out and they were in the middle of nowhere, like after they burst through the gate in the car.
Yeah.
And they were all just like looking at it or something.
That
like,
would have been
nice. I'd been like, that's, I do like them sort of going back to their lives, but I don't know if it's necessary. Something like that. But that's just a weird nitpicky kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because I would have ended it before their escape or something, or right after that. Through the door, the card goes through the gate and they're outside or whatever.
Yeah,
that would have been my ending.
Yeah, I like the end. I always thought that the gunfight was a little weird, and the driving away. I actually really like the scene when they're driving. They're all just kind of chilling out and dancing.
Oh, see, I guess my dislike goes further. I didn't like them. Well, I guess it's really just the butler. I didn't understand the butler going along with them. That seemed a little bit weird. I can understand 2 and 48 because they've now
become
revolt.
Well, I mean, the butler transfers his allegiance to number 6.
Yes.
So he's going to leave with number 6.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
Which, again, as the show is wont to do, has the fact that the show ends with the butler entering the house with number 1 on it with the door opening like the village has started people saying that, oh, the butler is number 1. That's which I'm sure, which was a little bit, the fire was a little bit fanned by an interview that McGowan did, where someone asked him about Angelo Muscat, the guy, the actor, and he's like, oh yeah, he was great. It'd be really crazy if he was actually number one, wouldn't it? And everyone's head just exploded.
Yeah, I can see that. I felt his role was a little strong. It felt almost like McGowan is like, you've been here for all these episodes. I'll give you a little bit of action at the end.
He's been the only other character, well, with the exception of one or maybe two episodes. I think he's the only other person who's been in every episode.
Yeah.
I really like the ending when they get back. I think it's a little drawn out.
Yes.
Like there's this pageantry to saying goodbye to the characters.
That's what I felt too.
Yeah, I feel like it's unearned.
Yeah.
Because it's not like number 48 and Leo McKern have been there with you the whole show.
Right. It's yes, exactly. It's just like these are the people who happen to be in this episode, and they get a weird sort of credit at the end.
I do like the thing about them going back to like kind of their quote unquote homes, where although it is kind of strange if you think about it, because the whole point of their beings in the episode was to be examples of this form of revolt, and dropping Alexis Kanner on the side of the road makes sense because he's kind of like back in, you know, in the ether.
Yep.
But having Leo McKern just go back to work,
well,
is kind of weird.
I feel it's them accepting their place as, see, because I saw it as what Six learns through this is that he's still part of the village, which is just another sort of term for society, essentially.
Yeah.
So he's kind of just content with, he knows he's going to be himself in this society.
Yeah.
And so like it makes sense to me that he goes back to work. We don't know that Six goes back to work. Certainly, mm-hmm. Leo McKern's number two goes back to work because he walks in with his briefcase, but I sort of liked it. The one scene I didn't really care for at the end, I didn't understand that long shot of the butler in the foreground and Six talking to a cop in the background, and he's like acting very...
I think what he's doing there is he's like, because the cop seems very...
suspicious of the
butler. Suspicious, but also like doesn't really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I think what Six is actually doing is explaining to him everything that just happened. Because he goes, you know, throws his arm up.
Yeah, right.
Like, alluding to the rocket going up. And it's like, didn't you see, like, these explosions and this rocket shot up? And,
right.
And the cop's just like, I don't know.
Yeah, it just felt a lot out of... I'm just thinking about the thing now. It felt out of character for Six. And when he and the butler held hands and ran out to the
That's really cute, though. I mean,
it's adorable.
Yeah,
but it's very.
I mean, because you know, you want to make sure he gets across the street safely.
Very funny.
But yeah, the I think you're right about the larger thing of it being about Six being realizing he will. He has won in that he is himself, but he's part of this larger quote unquote village.
Yep.
You know, implied by the way the door opens and the cyclical nature of the ending. And
yep.
I think it's interesting because I think you can read the very last shot a couple ways where it's
with him in his car.
Yeah. Him in his car, because you can read it as a negative of him, of the fact that it is exactly the same shot that begins the episodes.
Yep.
So you can read it as a cyclical thing. Or you can read it as kind of almost a triumphant thing, because it's like that shot of him, you know, just driving. You know, he's out.
He's free.
Back on the road. He's free. And I think that the ambiguity of that aspect I really like, where you can go either way in how you interpret that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it's a problematic last shot. I think it generally worked. I think it all makes sense. It makes sense to me, so I'm having a hard time coming up with a criticism as to like why didn't this work.
Well, you know,
outside of minor technical things that I think could have been eliminated or done better.
It's caused a lot of interpretation of different things in it, like especially the number one scene, where I mean, I think the overall intention is pretty clear, and McGowan. In an interview that I think we might cover next week in our wrap up, he says Number One was depicted as an evil governing force in the village. Now this overriding evil force is at its most powerful within ourselves, and we have to constantly fight it, I think. And that's why I made Number One an image of Number Six, his other F, his alter ego. Which I think, you know, is perfectly explained.
Yep.
When you get into the specifics of what actually is going on, I feel like it's kind of really up for debate depending on who you talk to. Because I've been reading the AV Club reviews.
Yep.
And the guy who was talking about that episode, you know, he did a breakdown of the whole thing. Then he got to the end and he was describing what happened and what he thought was happening.
Sure.
And he says, Number One is just the last true individual to defeat the village and thus getting installed as its leader. And I was like, well, I never really read it that way, that it was like...
This is what the AV Club reviewer wrote?
Yeah.
Okay.
I never really took it as this was supposed to be like the Matrix, where every 20 years...
Yeah, a new...
There's a new chosen one or some right. shit, you know? I didn't read it like that at all.
No, I didn't get that interpretation either. I did read his review, and I didn't really agree with his sort of overall perception of it. I think that's kind of a big... Because, no, I don't, like, I don't think, because Number One, in my interpretation of this is sort of, Number One is not a real position.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
Sort of, like, you just are, if you want to get real symbolic, it's just you are your Number One in the village of your life or whatever,
right,
like, however
exactly.
you want to pursue it. So I don't,
yeah.
Like, everyone in the village going in would run into themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like he becomes the leader. It's sort of everyone is at a certain point. So
right.
I don't really understand. I
yeah.
don't know.
I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered. My life is my own.
The way that I was reading it this time, completely ascribed to what McGoohan's saying, but I was actually watching the sequence again and paying attention to what was going on, because it's so specific, or I should say it's so deliberate, the actions that happen, that...
With the unmasking of One you're
yeah,
talking about.
That I was kind of... A new way of looking at it, in terms of what is actually going on,
mm-hmm.
popped into my head, which was that it's that moment where Six makes his decision whether or not he's going to lead the village or escape.
Right.
Because, honestly, this may sound like total bullshit, but humor me for a second.
Mm-hmm.
As you've been doing for 17 episodes. One turns to him and hands him a crystal ball.
Yeah.
You know, as One uses it like a fortune teller to see your future.
Yeah.
And he looks into it and he sees the bars closing on his face. And it's from that point that I feel like it's kind of like a Ghost of Christmas Future kind of thing.
Sure.
Where he realizes that he's kind of looking into his own future, where if he chooses to run the village, he
right.
is going to turn into this, you know, crazy madman.
Right.
And it's at that point where he makes the decision that
he's going to leave.
He's going to leave.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Because
they are offering
him, this person we've already determined is kind of a narcissist,
yep.
this opportunity for absolute power.
Yep.
And absolute power, as the saying goes, corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at that point that he rejects that and decides that he's going to destroy the village instead.
Yeah, smashes the snow globe or whatever and then...
Yeah.
Yeah. No. I guess I can't disagree with that.
That's the thing. I mean, that's the great thing about this episode. I mean, you could tell me something completely well, except for maybe what the AV Club guy says. I don't really agree with that. But But you know, it's one of those things where you can just, as we'll find out when we watch that interview with McGoohan, it's the first big interview he ever gave about the show.
Yeah.
And it's like in front of a bunch of college kids and
youthful revolt.
Yeah. The shit they're throwing at him.
Yeah.
Like, saying like, well, clearly that your use of Angela Muscat is reference to,
your short temper.
Yeah. The concept of the Greek epic, and he's like, I just thought he was a nice guy. I didn't really wasn't thinking about that at all.
Yeah,
a lot of that stuff.
That happens with TV too. People into TV. There's a Wire interview they did. The showrunners and a bunch of the writers and actors did, and it's the same thing. It's in front of like, it's either students. Or it's probably students who are into like a television production or something course. And it's spoiler alert for The Wire, but it has to do with how you familiar with The Wire?
Oh yeah,
where Avon and Stringer sort of mutually betray each other at the same time in season 3, and the student got up and explained that he's just like, it just like glowing, or just like that was the most brilliant thing I've ever seen in my life. And Ed Burns is the one who came up with it. He's a cop who turned into the writer on the show, and he's just like, I think you need to get out more. He's like, it was an okay idea, but it's like, he's kind of shrugging, being like, yeah, it worked out, but it's like, I don't know what to tell you.
It's a magic xylophone question.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And like, Q&As, every time I go to a Q&A with a director or something at a screening, they're so disappointing,
because
all you get are those bullshit questions. Like, I went to one, I went to see the, William Friedkin, the director of The Exorcist, just had a movie. One of his movies got re-released called Sorcerer. Awesome movie. Highly recommend it. And he was doing a screening of it where he was doing a Q&A afterwards at the Harvard Film Archive. And he, you know, all the questions he were getting were just like, you know, about other movies that would he would launch into stories from like his book about those movies.
Right.
And then one guy got up and he said, yeah, I remember seeing this movie on TV. I remember seeing what was it? Cruisin', one of his Al Pacino movie. I remember seeing Cruisin' on TV, and I remember distinctly seeing a scene in which Karen Allen is dressed as the killer, and her reflection is in the mirror of the bathroom. But any other time I've seen that movie, I ain't seen that scene. And William Friedkin was like, "Yeah, that scene's not in the movie." The guy goes, well, I very distinctly remember seeing that scene. And he's like, I don't know what to tell you. That scene's not in the movie.
Two things about that. It's your memories basically overtake you.
Yeah.
You know, like, or not even true memories. Like, what you think happened eventually, like, replaces what actually happened.
Oh, yeah.
And just people are super unwilling to admit to coincidence. People are always like, there is a reason that this happened.
Yeah.
And that's, it's more complicated than that, I think. TV is just a small sampling of it. When you try to like come up with like global explanations for things, it's like you cannot even comprehend the amount of coincidence that has gone into creating these things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's not to go completely off topic. Well, I mean, it's technically not off topic because it's kind of a village type thing, but the idea that people believe in conspiracies, that they think that people of the world of different governments have their shit together enough that they could pull something off.
They can do something,
like, you know,
the towers or...
Yeah, any one of those quote-unquote inside job type things.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that... I read somewhere that someone talked about... Maybe we've already talked about this on the show, but someone said... The reason people believe in those things is because it is the more comforting option than to believe that the world is just run by idiots and,
random shit happening. Yeah.
Which, you know, makes a lot of sense.
Basis for religion, right?
Yeah.
Well, back to the prisoner.
We'll start on Wes's podcast, The Problems with Religion.
See,
Penske File goes through all of the different religions of the world.
DDoS attack. The, I mean, to tie that back, I would have had the president or whatever the fuck he's called be a priest. Makes more sense. Like, be some sort of like something more. Because his role is pretty ambiguous. He's sort of dressed as a judge, but he's sort of dressed as like a Admiral Redcoat kind of. Like, he's not wearing the black robes. He's wearing like a red military outfit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So his role is kind of ill defined. And I think just like this is a super minor improvement, but if you like had put him as something...
Why do you hate the show?
Something other. It might have been a little bit different.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I don't disagree. I think...
Because the only reason we think he's a judge is because he's wearing their wigs, right? The judges wear.
Yeah.
He has a gavel, I guess, but it's like... Yeah, okay.
But yeah, I think the thing that makes this show so long-lasting is the fact that it is so open to interpretation.
Yep.
And has... I mean, the fact that we're doing a podcast about it 40-something years after it came out is... Well, I just... I guess... Is it 40? I guess... Yeah, it's probably... Yeah. But
40, yeah, 40-something, right?
It's... We wouldn't be talking about this nearly as much if we got to the last episode and it was, you know, the last scene from The Matrix Revolution where he talks to the architect.
Yep.
Or was it Snowpiercer or whatever? I think that's what, you know, we can get into more of this next week when we do our wrap up, but I think that's one of the things that makes the show so interesting is that we talked about it a little bit about how McGoohan notoriously just kept his mouth shut.
Yep.
Because I think he liked the response that it was getting. The fact that nobody could figure it out or it meant something different to everybody really intrigued him, and it's like this is you know, what art is supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The one quote that the AV Club writer uses in his review is a quote from number 6 from The Chimes of Big Ben, when the art reviewers are looking at his sculpture and he says, it means what it is.
Yeah.
And that's the exact idea that he's playing with. He's like, yeah, I mean, I have what I thought going into it, but you know, it means whatever you take away from it. And I'm, you know,
well, I guess that's the problem with Q&As, right? Sometimes you don't want an A. You just just be like, this was better before you told me what you intended.
Yeah, it's like I mentioned before, Ray Bradbury being told what Fahrenheit 451 was really about.
Sir, you approve the proceedings.
I note them.
Sir, I take it you have no comment at this stage.
Not at this stage.
So, a little bit of trivia for this episode. This episode, as I mentioned, was written in 36 hours. It's funny because I would actually believe that Once Upon a Time was written in 36 hours because so much of the dialogue in that is just like letters and numbers. You know, going 6, 1, 6, 5, 1, 6, 1, you know, back and forth.
Yes.
This one.
You don't have to. Once Upon a Time is such an easy, quick draft because you don't have to think about scene structure because mm-hmm. they're in one place.
Right.
You don't have to lay out in your mind where the skeleton of what's going to happen is because you can just stream of consciousness, get it out on the paper.
Yeah.
This one's sort of similar, but it does move around a little bit. He doesn't really cut between things, but it's a very linear sort of line.
Yeah. I and I think the stuff that's going on is pretty specific too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's surprising that if this is like a first draft thing, then...
Yeah. Man, no, it's a good first draft.
Dude should have written more stuff.
Right, yeah.
He's a pretty good writer. In this episode, McGoohan receives no on-screen acting credit or executive producer credit, which he gets in every other episode. He's only referred to as the prisoner at the end.
And directed credit.
Yes, he gets the written and directed credit, yes. The reason Leo McKern's hair was trimmed and changed in color was because... Fallout and Once Upon a Time were shot a year apart. And
he looks thinner, too.
Yeah, he does. Less like he's about to die on screen.
He probably took his near stroke to be a sign.
And just in that year, he had just changed his look. So they had to come up with that thing, which is kind of hokey, but I think it
fits. It could have been a lot worse, but I think it works fairly well.
Yeah, I don't think it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty effective, or at least it doesn't stand out
as
much. This is the only episode to feature a pop song, All You Need Is Love by the Beatles. And it was...
A small band that didn't end up going anywhere, unfortunately.
Unfortunately not. and they subsequently kept the song in on all the home video releases, which is kind of odd because there are other shows that also use Beatles songs at the time, like Doctor Who, where
they stripped it out.
Yeah, the song was removed. So I don't know. I don't know what
Beatles
the deal
are. I don't understand the... Whoever is controlling the Beatles intellectual property or whatever you want to call it, I don't understand what they're doing. Because I was watching it and I was thinking, you hardly ever see Beatles songs and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mad Men famously blew like their whole season budget
on one thing.
Yeah. This had one of the largest, as I mentioned, one of the largest viewing audiences ever, and they were all very upset. And McGoohan went into hiding for a few days, but he was very happy with the reaction that it got.
Sure.
So one of the other things I'd like to mention is the alternate ending, which comes from James Follett, who is a protege of George Markstein, and he says that Markstein had mapped out an explanation for the village. In George Markstein's mind, a young John Drake, the lead character in Danger Man, had once submitted a proposal for how to deal with retired secret agents who posed a security risk. Drake's idea was to create a comfortable retirement center where former agents could live out their final years enduring firm but unintrusive surveillance, pretty much in line with what happened.
Yep.
Years later, Drake discovered that this idea had been put into practice and not as a benign means of retirement, but instead as an interrogation center and a prison camp. Outraged, Drake staged his own resignation, knowing he would be brought to the village. He hoped to learn everything he could of how his idea had been implemented and find a way to destroy it. However, due to the range of nationalities and agents present in the village, Drake realized he was not sure whose village he was in, the one brought about by his own people or the other side. Drake's conception of the village would have been the foundation of declaring him to be number one. However, Markstein's falling out with McGoohan resulted in Markstein's departure, and his story arc was discarded. According to Markstein, quote, "Well, who is number six is no mystery. He was a secret agent called Drake who quit. The matter of conscience," end quote. "The matter of conscience which motivated his resignation could then easily be interpreted as Drake having had enough top secret information in his mind and at his disposal to start a war, and that coupled with his long-standing desire to keep peace, would have meant that he could not even trust his own government with it any longer." Markstein added, "The prisoner was going to leave the village and he was going to have adventures in many parts of the world, but ultimately he would always be a prisoner. By that, I mean he wouldn't always go back to the village. He would always be a prisoner of his circumstances, his situation, his secret, his background, and they," quote, "would always be there to ensure that his captivity continues."
Yep.
I mean,
it's fairly generic.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it's a reasonable... it's a reasonable explanation for everything, but it's like, I don't really know if watching that ending would be satisfactory to me.
I think it's logical in a sense. It's illogical in the fact that all the episodes leading to that don't seem to imply that's what's the twist is sort of going to be.
Yeah.
Like Six has done a very good job of acting like he has no idea what's happening.
Yeah.
For a very long time.
Right.
If you're going to reveal that he now knows why he's in there and he's trying to, you know, flip the tables on everyone. That doesn't really work for me in that terms of that.
Right. And there is, so as we've talked about in the past, there is this conception that, or I should say perception, not conception, that McGoohan didn't know what was going on. He didn't know where the show was going. It was a mess, et cetera, sure. et cetera. Lou Grade has gone on record in interviews saying that, you know, he assured him that he had an ending, and then he came to him a few days like before they were shooting, and he's like, "I don't know, I don't have an ending."
Yep.
And Lou Grade said, it was really nice of him to come and tell me that. And I maintain,
tell the bank you can't make your payments.
Yeah. I maintain my feeling on that, of course, I don't know because I can't talk to the guy.
Yep.
But is that he had an ending. He knew how it was going to end. He just didn't know how he was going to get there.
Sure.
You know, it's like if you're writing The Sixth Sense, you say, oh, the kid sees dead people. Oh, the guy helping him through the whole movie is a ghost. Spoilers yep. for The Sixth Sense.
Mm-hmm.
But
great movie. Yeah, still holds up very well on rewatch.
But I don't really know how I'm going to get from the beginning to the reveal that he is at. You know, so I think
right.
I think the idea that number one is number six or vice versa is not is something that had been there all along.
Yep.
I mean, yep. One of the other big things that everybody seems to blow everybody's mind when they notice this, also up to interpretation, I think, is in the opening credits, you have the who are you? And he says, the new number two. Who is number one? The response is, you are number six. Whether or not there's a comma in that sentence makes all the difference. And the way that the different actors read it, most of them read it as you are, comma. I'm sorry.
Most of them put the stress on you.
Yeah. Most of them read it without a comma. So right, you are number six, saying that that is your number.
Yep.
The way Leo McKern reads it, there's like ever so much of a smidgen of a pause that you could infer that he's saying you are number six.
Yep.
As in, you are number one.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
And whether or not that's intentional, I don't know. But there are so many other references to the fact that six might be the one in charge. Six might be number one. Yep. I don't even know if I want to say references that he might be number one. But that through line, it runs through the series.
Yeah, yeah.
There's, I mean, even in Once Upon a Time, we talked about how there's a back and forth where there's an exchange where McKern says, he thinks you're the boss now. And Six says, I am the boss.
Yep.
And
yep.
McKern says, I'm number two. I make the rules.
Right.
And I'm the boss. And he says, number one is the boss. And, you know, I mean, that that right there is like, it's like, well, I mean, if you extrapolate that out a little bit, you kind of come to a conclusion.
Yeah. That's some kind of logical A. If A is A and B is B, then
exactly.
A.
Yeah. So, I mean, even stuff like that, it's really interesting. But it goes to back to what I was saying is that I don't think that it tying up the way it did is a coincidence. I think he knew at least what he was doing.
Sure.
And the Markstein thing, I just think is, I don't know. He just sounds so bitter.
Sour grapes.
Yeah. It just sounds like he wanted something that he wanted to go one way. Magoon wanted to go the other way. Magoon won the battle. So Markstein was just kind of pissy about it.
Sure.
A man magnificently equipped to lead us. That is, lead us. Or go.
So, I think we could probably rate the plan in this one if we're going with the idea that they're basically trying to offer him everything in order to get him to lead them or at least come over to their side.
Yeah.
How would you rate this plan?
They did it. It's a six.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first six. Scale of one to six. They, because my interpretation of it is that they accomplished their goal that they set out to. Which leads to sort of a happy ending, sort of, I guess it'd be called bittersweet. It's not even bittersweet, it's sort of triumphant, but it's more of a realization as to where Six is in his place in the world, kind of.
So when you say they succeeded, what did they succeed at?
They succeeded in making him realize what his situation is.
Yeah, okay. I believe that. So, if they succeed, I guess it would be a six. Yeah, I would say as far as like the idea of a plan, I would say it's a definite five. Regardless of whether or not they quote unquote succeed,
sure.
I think it was a great idea.
Yep.
Because you know they took a completely different tack, and it was playing into the only aspect of his personality that we've never explored yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it was really really interesting idea and made for great television. So I guess in that case, then I feel like I shouldn't even ask this question because we've already talked about how it doesn't matter. But, if you wanted to get down to it into the specifics of things, do you think he escapes or do you think he's going back?
I think he escaped from that specific location. And like McKern said, the village is now global.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he escapes from his false idea of what reality is, if that makes sense. So he kind of escapes, but he's still in the prison, which is life, I guess, would be the point of the series.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one of those questions that you can't really answer in the way that most people are going to ask it.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, do you think he got out at the end? It's like, well, I mean, yes and no.
Right.
I mean, there's a comic book sequel called Shattered Visage, I think, that DC actually put out in the, I want to say the 80s, that is supposed to be a direct sequel to the show. And I believe it starts with him being like mentally broken. So I believe the way that book works is they posit that, much like I said, at like the end of Brazil, that fallout is actually all in Six's mind.
Sure.
And that he is actually broken in Once Upon a Time. Which is an interesting way to look at it. I guess you could do that. I don't know. Well, we won't get into that. Maybe we'll talk about that next week.
Pick up the book.
Yeah. But yeah, I just don't think it's a question that really matters, or you can really answer the way people think you'll answer it. Yeah, but I think that's a wrap up for Fallout, for the series there.
Prisoner.
Yeah.
All 17 episodes. We wrapped it up, and it worked out pretty well. It's been fun. It's been a good 17 episodes.
I think next week we're going to do a series wrap up. We can talk about our thoughts about the series as a whole. I think we're going to look at an interview that I was talking about with McGowan that I'll put in the show notes this week. I believe it's on YouTube. I believe it's referred to as the Vern Troyer, not Vern Troyer. That's fucking idiot. That would be a great interview, though. Sorry, it's the Troyer interview. I don't know what his first name is, but in my head, I said Vern Troyer.
Oh, man.
Patrick McGowan being interviewed by Mini-Me from Austin Powers would be a very interesting interview, but that's not what it is.
That's too bad.
And also, we were talking about doing a giveaway of a print of piece of Prisoner art. So yeah, stay tuned for my usual outro for details about how we're going to give that print away, and we'll
you can find the print on the website.
Yeah, right, so. And we'll announce who the winner is next week during our wrap up show.
Absolutely.
And obviously, as I say every week, I am by no means an expert on any of this, so if you'd like to talk about it... I mean, you know what? Since we're doing the wrap-up next week, if there's anything you'd like to get off your chest about the show...
Yeah, give us a quotable quote.
Yeah, write in to us at theprisonerpodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet it to us at @prisonerpodcast, and if you've got some things you want to discuss or point of views on things, send it our way, and it's the perfect time for us to talk about that stuff.
Or maybe you are the one who is podcasting. So write to yourself, leave a note. Yeah, but that'd be good. Send in quotes, send in anything. We'll put on as much information on the podcast as you want, name, whatever.
Yeah. And do you have anything you'd like to plug, Wes?
Sure, you can go to thepenskyfile.com, or you can go to thepenskypodcast.com. We're doing a Star Trek run through Next Generation. Clay helps me out occasionally. We're up to season 3. Things are really cooking. You can check that out on iTunes as well.
Mm-hmm. And if you are listening on iTunes to this podcast, if you'd be so kind to give us a rating or a review, we'd be much obliged, because you know that always helps. And it will help greatly when we finish this podcast in like 2 weeks and it's just sitting there for years.
And then it becomes one of those podcasts I complained about before. It's like, iTunes needs to get rid of these.
Hey, well,
dead...
at least we finished, okay? That's at least true. We completed what we set out to
do. Oh, my God. Those podcasts that have like 2 episodes and they 4 years ago. And I'm like, oh, my God, this topic would be so interesting. Oh, it's dead.
Oh, well, they only covered the first 2 weeks of World War One. I guess we're never going to know what happened. But...
Yeah. How did it end?
Anyway, so that's it for Fallout. That's it for The Prisoner. The show. We will be back next week with a wrap up. We will see you guys then.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. There was Fallout. We made it to the end. Thank you guys so much for listening. It's been a blast to do this. Now, for next week, we're going to do a wrap up, as we said, and we're going to do a giveaway of a Prisoner number 6 art print that you can see on the website, backinthevillage.com. And how we're going to do this is, if you send an email to theprisonerpodcast@gmail.com with the subject heading, I am not a number, or if you follow us on Twitter @prisonerpodcast and tweet at us with the hashtag, I am not a number, your name will be entered with everybody else's name who does the same thing, and we will select one winner at random, and we will announce that next week. So get on it. You only have until 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Monday, June 22nd, to get your name into the drawing. All right, well, that's about it. We will see you next time. Bye.